Kamenetsky Brothers Podcast, Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky. It is Thursday, the
Wednesday,
the 23rd of
May 2018, in the year
of our
Lord.
Yeah. Right. That's great. That's just nice. I'm happy about that. So, Fairmount going on. We're getting closer and closer to the draft. Again, I'd like to remind people that when the Lakers put out those lists of who's showing up to El Segundo, Andy and I are not sure who the real people are and who the fakes are, who the decoys are.
Although the Greek Freak's little brother.
Yes, he's in this week.
Yeah, that today, I believe. I think he's actually working out as we speak.
Yeah. You know what they call that? Tampering.
That's kind of exciting, though.
And apparently,
too, LiAngelo is going to get a workout.
Yeah. Great.
Water mogul LiAngelo Ball.
Right. Actually, I haven't had a chance to look this up. Apparently the prices for those the Triple B League or whatever are astronomical. They're like the shoes. Like, so if you want to go see the little guy play with all of his NBA hopefuls, it's not like they're letting you in cheap, like minor league baseball or something.
Or like summer league. Yeah. Well, I mean,
pay a lot.
We've talked about this before. LeVar Ball, as a businessman, whether you like him or not, his approach is the equivalent of how Sasha approached making wine. Like, Sasha has two bottles of wine from his winery, and the least expensive bottle, I believe, is $75. That's the least expensive.
Which is, if you're a fine vintner.
Sure, but I'm
it's
just saying, like, Sasha.
Like, Sasha, for a guy starting at zero.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Sasha came out of the gate and is like $75, $95. I think he had like a $115 bottle. Boom. Like, even like Francis Coppola was like, well, we'll have
cheaper.
A $30, $25.
Right. And it wouldn't be such a big deal, except you look at him and you say, yeah, isn't that guy the shooting guard for the Knicks or whatever?
When you say, why would I buy wine from Sasha Vujicic?
I actually always say to myself, why wouldn't I buy wine from Sasha Vujicic? But anyway, so we'll see if I can find the details about that. Even if it's cheap, I'm not going. The price is not what's keeping me away from going to watch that minor league, but it is interesting. So we'll see if we can figure that out. But anyway, so there is some ground to cover, though, with the Lakers as we start getting into the draft and as July 1 approaches, because obviously that is a significant date for the league and the Lakers particularly. Let's start this week with Julius Randle. He is a restricted free agent. And there is probably, would you agree, Andy, nobody whose status as a Laker is in greater limbo than Randle, because it seems like, if the Lakers can keep him, they probably will. But he'd be the first guy to be sacrificed in the event of major free agent acquisitions.
Nobody's pendulum swings more wildly than could be brought back for like a 4-year $80 million deal or might not be on the team. Like, it's the extremes with Julius are wider than anybody else who played on the team last year.
All right. And so the politics are already out there and starting where Aaron Mintz, who is Randall's agent, and also, it should be noted, Paul George's agent.
I want to touch on that in a bit. But go ahead.
He said this week that he's a little confused. They're all a little confused as to what's going on with Randle. Quote, we still have no indication of where Julius stands among the Lakers' priorities or if he's still a priority at all, says Mintz. We are looking forward to the marketplace in July, and we will get a clear picture of Julius's future. I wouldn't expect, Andy, the Lakers to say anything much different than they already have. And this was from Rob Pelinka basically saying, look, we've been communicating, we're interested in Julius bringing back, but obviously the front office can't commit to something because they can't. And obviously Mintz is playing some politics here and setting a market and all these other things, but it does drive home the problem that the Lakers are going to be facing, because come July 1, it seems like, whether it's Dallas or someone else, somebody is going to put a pile of money in front of Randle quickly and force the Lakers into a decision.
Yeah, I mean, the Lakers really have to hope for the sake of their own plans that they come to some type of understanding with Paul George, who, again, is represented by Aaron Mintz, so maybe that part becomes a little bit more easy. But also, too, what's going on with LeBron and how long LeBron, who typically takes his time with these type of decisions and likes to, you know, turn free agency into his own personal carnival and have everybody pay attention. Why wouldn't you? If you're that guy
with
and
rides
you can do
and corn dogs
and carnies and crooked games that nobody can actually win because, you know, the ring won't fit around.
He's got so much money already. It seems to grift people like that over like gold.
Well, like, you know that the opening for that fishbowl, like it's not very big enough.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, the ball's not going in.
The fish aren't going to live much longer than a day anyway.
But I mean, like, you know, there's a lot that could go sideways potentially for the Lakers if they're looking to play this thing really cute, or, you know, if they're really willing to wait out LeBron. And, you know, things could change depending on what's going on with Kawhi Leonard, what, you know, if a guy like DeMar DeRozan ends up on the market, whatever. But there is a lot that could – the worst-case scenario for the Lakers is potentially striking out on pick your big name or pick your big names, and in that time waiting for those guys to come up with a decision, you lose Julius.
The good news is there is time.
So, sure.
Like, I think there are some people – kind of worry in that sense, like, oh, Dallas offers a contract on July 1 and the Lakers have to know by, you know, before the holiday whether or not they need to get it done. They still get I think it's basically a week before anybody can actually sign a deal, and then the Lakers would get to the 72 hours, so it's about 10 days, give or take.
I'm sure it's that long, but
it's
they have time. The point being,
it's over a week. I'm you know, when it's all set. This is where the tampering comes in.
I was just about to say that,
this
Brian.
This is where you got to have done enough of your homework that you have an idea of, you know what, we're in it with LeBron. We're not in it with LeBron. You know, because in theory, being in it with George and being in it with LeBron are two very different things. Being in it with all these other trades that may be going on somewhere else where maybe you want to let Randall go because you want to absorb a contract, or you want to be able, you can acquire somebody else some other way. You have to go in on July 1 with a really good idea of what the landscape is going to look like, because otherwise you are, Andy, I think, in that situation where maybe you just you're the paralysis of a deal on the table for Randall becomes problematic. I'm not as worried about it as I used to be. I think they'll have it together. But there are going to be a lot of moving parts this summer.
Well, I mean, and what I think is interesting about Mintz's comments, because like we noted, he also reps Paul George. So in theory, he would have a decent inside track on what the Lakers are thinking, because, you know, he has an opportunity to be in contact with Rob and Magic all the time, get a good idea of their thinking regarding Julius, the opportunity to talk around Paul George and, like, you know, sort of where the future and Paul George line up. It's all tied together. So there's a possibility that either A, Mintz may not really have a good sense of the Lakers thinking with Randall in the future, because they've sent definitive messages that Randall is kind of a back burner guy. There's
exactly
interest and there's vague, or it's vague because Magic and Rob have not done nearly enough tampering.
I think Aaron Mintz knows exactly what the deal is. He knows that the Lakers, if they don't get LeBron, if LeBron comes with Paul George and, you know, they facilitates another, they're not going to keep Randall. They don't have the space for him. If LeBron doesn't come, then I think they want to keep Randall. And I think, you know, Mintz knows that. He's also trying to make sure that there's a market for his client. So,
I understand that.
Basically what it comes down to is Julius Randall is a priority. He is not the priority. And it's funny because, and this sort of gets us into some of the other stuff that's been reported on this week, you know, Tanya Ganguly wrote a story for the LA Times, which essentially amounts to the Lakers love the young core. They'd love to develop them. Nobody's untouchable, which is, you know, essentially we're open to anything, which is exactly what it should be.
Interesting, though, because we are just a year removed from Magic describing Brandon Ingram as untouchable and the front office treating Lonzo before he had done anything as untouchable. I mean, they presented him as an untouchable,
right,
transcendent franchise face.
I think, though, this is less about feeling differently about those players as it is understanding you're supposed to speak.
I get that. I'm just saying it's interesting. It's like we talked about this before, Brian. Like, there would potentially be, you know, a period for the Lakers, you know, in the not-so-distant future where we are going – where, say, LeBron and Paul George are on the team – and we're with Lonzo, And we're just going to have to pretend that that whole franchise base transcendent player
for
thing
sure. all
like
of
it. Never happened.
But of all of it,
never
this
got
is,
said.
But this is, I mean, it all, this is where
I'm not saying there's anything right, bad about or whatever. I'm just saying it's hilarious.
It is, and we're making mistakes.
It's hilarious
it's a mistake
to me
of what they were doing before about, you know, talking about guys as the future of the franchise while also saying that, oh, by the way, but as soon as we get the guys who are better than you with the two max free agents, someone you guys are gonna have to take a back seat. I mean, it's just. It was why they shouldn't have been using the language that they were using before. But, you know, I mean, currently it's just that setup where we're open to everything. Nobody is untouchable. Nobody on this team should be untouchable. You get back to it. You know, we touched on it a little bit last week, Andy. Toronto could be moving those guys, their backcourt. Portland could be moving guys in their backcourt. Boston has too many good players and might be in a situation where they want to trade Kyrie Irving.
The Wizards
need to break up. And it's interesting, by the way, that all these teams that seem to be failing have high-powered 1-2 combos. You know what that tells me? I don't know if I want a high-powered 1-2 combo on my team as what drives it, because that doesn't seem to be a great formula. But
It depends on the combo.
It depends on the combo.
The Rockets right now are tied 2-2 against the Warriors, and they are decidedly powered by a 1-2 combo.
They are, but they managed to fill it out better with, you know, they have that dominant third piece in terms of defensive play with Capella that I think has changed them a little bit. But it does seem that you better have some really other good pieces, or Harden and Paul, as opposed to, you know, Lowry and DeRozan, which is a pretty good combo, or McCollum and Lillard, which is a really good combo. Like, one of those dudes, if you're going to
have a backup like that. Unfortunately, Serge Ibaka went very quickly from potential third guy to, how do we play him?
Yeah, icky.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately where it fell apart for Toronto. I think they thought they had that guy.
Sure, it's hard to do better as a backcourt combination in terms of pure talent than Bradley Beal and John Wall.
Yeah.
I mean, John Wall is really good, but he's not James Harden. And so, you know, there's a threshold, I guess, maybe you
also
have
hurts
to
if they can't stand playing together.
The whole team seems to not enjoy being with each other.
Yes.
Like, a lot.
Yes. I mean, that also, though, prevents you from reaching a ceiling.
But anyway, so all of these moving parts make it so the Lakers can't go into this offseason with an iron.
No, nobody on this team has earned the right to be considered
untouchable. Like, you know, we won't do this, we will do this, because they're the only team that has young assets and gobs of cap space. Other teams have some cap space, but the Lakers have gobs of it. And so, you know, they shouldn't have a preconceived notion, but I think it's fair to say that Rob Pelinka has got about 9,000 different plans that have been laid out. So I'm not worried about
that. He speaks
of
all of them in very flowery terms. And biblical.
So, I mean, I'm not surprised by any of the news that's coming out of El Segundo and the fact that it's all very vague and non-committal towards anything in particular. But it does get you to thinking, like, what would, if you had to rank these guys
in terms of touchability.
In terms of touchability. Let's look at the scene in The Untouchables. Like the accountant, that guy was touchable.
Yeah.
As they showed when they wrote touchable.
Well, he unfortunately
in his blood.
He unfortunately
over his
was
body
not
in the elevator.
He was unfortunately not touchable in the expendable sense. He was touchable in the sense he wasn't protected enough.
They killed him.
Yeah, well, I mean,
and
like,
then hung him in an elevator.
Yeah.
And then used his blood to deface the elevator. Yeah, in graffiti.
You know what that is? It's pounding your point.
It's a tough way to go.
It's pounding your point
at
home.
It's really driving that home.
Al Capone was not a man of subtlety.
No. And so, yeah, if you had to rank these guys, though, in the order of touchability to untouchability, which sounds not... to steal the line from Arrested Development when...
no touching. No touching.
What's his name? Who's the actor that plays... I blew myself.
Oh, that's David Cross.
David Cross. So he paints his face blue and he says, you know, he's joining the Blue Man Group. And he says, I blew myself. And Jason Bateman says, there's got to be a better way to say that. The touchability to untouchability, same thing. Let's go through Ingram, Lonzo, Kuzma. We'll throw Randall in there.
He's part of the conversation.
He's in a different place, but all things being equal, we'll pretend. Hart, Bryant, Caruso.
Just the five guys who matter.
You don't want to do Caruso?
No.
We assume we'll both start with Caruso as most expendable?
Thomas Bryant and Alex Caruso don't count. That's why I'm not including them. They don't count.
No Zubats?
No.
All right. Who's your number five?
I don't care if Zubats on the team next year. My number five was Josh Hart.
Although I
have to say, Hart's leadership potential made me debate ranking him higher than his pure ceiling might justify. Like, he seems like he could end up a better version of Derek Fisher. And Fisher was a really important part of Kobe's five championships, particularly the latter two, when Fisher was, like, the only teammate that Kobe would inexplicably trust, even when there was so much tangible evidence. Like, no, really, you should trust Powell or Bynum or Lamar more than Fisher. Like, him trusting Fisher, like, helped get him, I think, back on the same page with the Lakers, and just, you know, the idea that he would give up the ball to eventually have it go somewhere else from Fisher mattered. And Fisher had some big moments in the playoffs as well. And, you know, Hart to me looks like he could be a legit good rotational starter.
I have him at five as well, but he's so that guy that a team will ask for him because there's sort of no downside. You know, he's going to be a good player in the league for a while, probably never a star, but just a good player. And where it's like, okay, if it means we get Kawhi Leonard, you have to make that deal.
Sure.
If it's like, you know, we're going to get John Wall, you have to make. But man, it hurts to put him in. Like, you really hate putting him in that deal. In a lot of ways, it's like Larry Nance, except I was more willing to move Nance because Nance, as we've seen a little bit in the playoffs, seems to ebb and flow in terms of his confidence, in terms of his sort of willingness to put an imprint on a game and things like that in ways that I don't think Hart will.
I
think Hart takes much more ownership and exudes a leadership and a confidence.
I was going to say, Hart, if he's on this team in 5 years, you know, and remove, like, you know, what established all-star could be a part of it, Paul George, LeBron, whatever. I'm just saying among this core of young players, Josh Hart will be one of the leaders on this team, even if he's the fifth or sixth best player on the team. Hart will be one of the leaders.
Number four.
I went back and forth on this. It was hard.
And we'll get to this at the end, but this was difficult.
Yes.
Putting these guys in order like this was very difficult.
I went back and forth between Julius Randle and Lonzo,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately I landed on Randle, but it's closer. It's hard. And the way I would sum it up, beyond the fact, I mean, I think anybody who listens to this podcast or listens to us on 710 knows we're both big Randle fans. We've been Randle fans since he entered the league. And, you know, the leap that he made this year as a player, particularly defensively, really shows his value in the modern NBA. Randle's ceiling, I think, is theoretically lower than Lonzo, but there are a lot of times that I have more confidence that Randle will reach his absolute highest ceiling than Lonzo.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, and also too, it's like he's still 23.
Still 23.
And if he, you know, we all woke up one day and Brook Lopez suddenly was a competent 3-point shooter.
Exactly.
After 10 years in the league. And I was listening to, you know, Ireland was saying that, you know, that apparently Randle goes out and he shoots 1,000 3-pointers a day. 1,000. 500 in the morning. Then he has a snack. And he shoots 500 in the afternoon. And he has a sensible dinner.
So knew that's where you were going.
Shake for
keep,
breakfast.
No, keep going. Keep going.
But I
don't want to go down this
sometimes
rabbit hole.
Sometimes you just have to entertain yourself. So if he's doing that, I refuse to believe that a person who shoots 1,000 three-pointers a day for like a summer and then comes back and does it again next summer and then does it again, by the time he's, I don't know, 27, won't be at least good enough to do it in a game.
And Julius Randle is one outside shot away from being literally the perfect NBA big. Like, perfect.
Right.
You know, I mean,
he can handle the ball.
He can score. You know, whatever lack of length does not bother him scoring inside against bigger players.
Right, and
he can switch on defense.
As he gets older, it could be more problematic. He loses some of the explosiveness and athleticism.
You know what? People said that about Zach Randolph for, like, the last
true.
10 years.
He got a lot savvier. Zeebo's a little longer, though.
A little longer, but not much. I mean,
maybe he's got longer reach.
And Randle is more explosive,
right,
though, than Zeebo has never jumped.
But that's my point, is when Randle's explosiveness starts to go, you could worry about, other, you know,
it's
whether
a
or not
long way
he's
from
23.
Now.
I'm not worried about that right
yes.
now. And so
the versatility,
the second max contract he gets. So if you tell me there's a 50% chance of him developing a solid outside shot, and it's probably higher than that. I mean, you could bump him up way higher.
I went back and forth. Really,
want to keep the guy around.
Like really, 3 and 4. I went back and forth, but in a lot of ways, 2 through 4. I thought about different combinations, but you know, the separation, certainly between 3 and 4 for me, wasn't that big.
Pull Julius out of the all things being equal equation that we set this up with for a second, because obviously all things are not equal in reality. Given what we just talked about, if somebody puts out $22 million a year for Randle and you have the space, LeBron says no, or you just don't think he's coming, whatever it is, would you give it to him?
Yes. Without hesitation. Yes. I wouldn't even think about it.
I think it probably would, too. It feels like a lot of
again,
money.
Again, I mean, moving the LeBron part of it, Paul George, whatever. Like, you obviously have to have the space for this.
Right.
If Julius Randle continues to play the way he's been playing, there's a chance he could end up looking like he's underpaid in the, you know, in the NBA moving forward. But at the very least, he will be movable.
Right.
You will be able to move him.
And who else are you going to get
exactly.
that puts up the same numbers that won't exactly. cost you the same amount of money?
I mean, Julius
Randle. And that person is much more likely to be 29 or 30 than they are 23.
He's one of the best free agents on the market. He is.
I think if you go after the superstars, he's the best non-superstar.
Yes. Yes. There's no question.
Yeah, so,
number 3, I had Lonzo.
And this is where it gets hard, too.
We've discussed this a lot during the year. Lonzo's rookie year was difficult to peg. It's all extremes. Like, the stuff he does well, he often does exceptionally well, and these are skills that can be hard to find in a point guard. And the stuff he does not do well, he does poorly for the time being, and it looks ugly while he struggles. Like, there's nothing Lonzo does like, yeah, he's fine at it. And those extremes, like, those extremes make you recognize, like, A, the possibilities for Lonzo if he can reach his true max, but also what could stand in the way, like what could hinder him. You know, like, you know, you can see where Lonzo could end up really, like...
Oh, if you don't fix X, you are, you know, that's your ceiling.
Like, yes.
There's a hard cap to what he can be.
There are
right.
Like, there are visual reminders to what could stand in Lonzo's way, and I'm going to be honest, too, I do have concerns about LeVar being in his ear too much. I do.
I'm glad you brought that up, because... I don't like, there's certain things about the whole, like, he's a perfectly nice kid.
Yes.
I mean, he seems perfectly nice and all that. I find a lot of the stuff around him annoying. You know, I find the Facebook stuff annoying. I find, you know, the
Facebook show you're referring to.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, and I find the sort of the marketing of Triple B's marketing of him, where it's both the shoe but also like this sort of, you know, smoldering Lonzo stares into the camera kind of, they're almost making him out to be like a model. I mean, it just is like, and some of the noise around him, which isn't really his fault, you know, his unwillingness to answer anything about anything ever, passing off, you know. I also think he's got a sort of a stupid hairline, but that's not his fault. Like he's missing an inch of his head. Head needs to be taller. That's not his fault.
It's probably a procedure
That's a me thing. Mm-hmm. That's me being judgmental and unfair. And who am I to judge anybody's hair?
Well, I mean, look, clearly you weren't being too petty about this because you didn't make him number 4.
No,
like you could have lowered him in the rankings because of his hair.
Just that. Yeah. Travis would have.
Travis absolutely would have.
Like, when he cut off the pencil eraser, I was like, oh, this will be better. And I was like, hey, it's really not.
No, the pencil eraser was better.
So, stuff like that. The hype around him and the, I can almost feel it becoming another, a different version of the, I'm going to have arguments about Lonzo in the same way that I had to have them about Kobe for like 10 years of my life. And it was so exhausting and counterproductive and stupid that I almost want to trade Lonzo just so I won't have to have those arguments. That's not fair to him.
Again.
But, I mean, do you understand what I'm getting? Like,
I do.
He has the potential to become a remarkably polarizing figure around the league.
He absolutely does. I mean, he already is.
Right. And whereas Kobe did that a lot based on his own personality, for Lonzo it would be...
But Kobe was also
completely,
Kobe.
Right. It would be stuff that's completely external to him. And so then I feel bad for him, and I feel like a jerk for thinking of the things that I'm thinking. But the potential is there. It's hard to separate some of the noise about Lonzo and the hype from Lonzo from what he's actually doing.
That,
and his play on the court, aside from the shot and the health, which is a big deal.
The health is a big deal. I have concerns about his durability.
Right.
I do.
And the, you know, those are things that are that matter. And so trying to put him above Kuzma, it's like I feel like I know exactly what Kuzma is capable of being. I feel like he's going to work hard at it. He's a little older, so I think, you know, we got to temper your expectations a little bit there. But he's obviously a very good scorer at this level, and if he improves his defense, he is...
He's already a good rebounder, too.
Pretty good rebounder, yeah. And if he improves his defense, he's an Antoine Jameson caliber guy, which is... Or maybe even a little better.
I think he's better. I think if he improves that, he's better.
But point being,
first of all, if he improves,
made All-Star team,
right? But if he improves his defense, then by definition, he's better than Antoine Jameson.
But he's not a better scorer yet than Jameson.
Maybe not. But
my point is, Jameson was an All-Star.
Yes,
and so that makes Kuzma an All-Star caliber player. Lonzo's transcend, but what Kuzma does is more conventional and kind of. Standard, for lack of a better term. It's valuable, but we know what it is. Lonzo still, though, has this appeal, and this is why I put him ahead of Kuzma.
So you have Kuzma 3, Lonzo 2?
2.
Okay.
Is if Lonzo really does hit in the way that everybody hopes he can, he's much closer to a unicorn than Kuzma is.
I would agree with that.
And I am tempted by the possibilities of what you can do with a Lonzo in 3 or 4 years when he really understands the league, the shot is fixed, still a great rebounder, the vision's there, he's, you know, got a better team around him with smarter, better players and all that kind of stuff. And so I hold on to him ahead of holding on to Kuzma, because I feel like if it turns out that you have something that's a little more special than what you have with Kuzma, and the floor with Lonzo is still quite high. You know, he's already a good player. And so even if he never quite gets there, he's still got a really good player.
Really quick before I get to why I had Kuzma at number two, and you obviously broke...
I've done my whole...
Right, I was going to say, you broke down, I mean, a lot of points that are positive about Kuzma that I'll get into. Really quick, when I was talking about LeVar, though, with Lonzo, I wasn't specifically referring to the noise that LeVar creates, you know, about Lonzo or the other two kids. I'm talking specifically concerns that LeVar...
No, I understand. Yeah, yeah.
I want to make sure it's clear, because it's not really what we touched upon. Like, concerns that LeVar's presence in Lonzo's life and the sway that he clearly holds over all three kids. I'm not saying that I think Lonzo is uncoachable now, and everything I've heard is that the staff enjoys working with him and that he puts in the work, whatever. But, you know, Lonzo is a very specific style of player, and the mm-hmm. style is all the way his dad sees the game. And by the way, I don't think that the way LeVar sees the game is necessarily wrong. Like, there are parts of it I would
disagree with.
Well, there are elements of it I think he's right, elements of it I think he's wrong. I mean,
LaMelo shooting from 47 feet.
Sure, I mean, but some of that,
never
though,
playing defense.
Sure, I was going to say, some of that, though, I think is just him trying to create hype around his children at the expense of their development. But that also, though, gets to, if Lonzo is, and I've never seen this before, I've never seen this in a player, Lonzo is a well-rounded player with terrible fundamentals, which is bizarre.
Well, some of his fundamentals.
Some of his fundamentals are terrible.
Right. Some are quite good, but some are bad.
But he's got a lot of wonky fundamentals, and I think, you know, the good end of it and the bad end of it in some ways reflects LeVar,
it just reflects
the concerns I have.
It's different when it's the dad than it is, oh, he's got an agent, or he's got an uncle,
yes,
or he's got someone.
Can't
fire your dad. I've tried really hard to kind of separate the things that are external to Lonzo that really have nothing to do with him that are more about, I just don't want to get into that.
Sure, sure.
And
but this to me is something that could affect him on the court.
I can picture myself becoming tired of the whole Lonzo thing.
No question.
Quickly.
With Kuzma, though, the ultimate reason that I had him number two that hasn't come up, you know, beyond the scoring, beyond, you know, the things that he does well, and he's got things he needs to clean up in his game. He is determined as anybody, I think, on that team to be as great as he can possibly be.
I agree.
Like, Kuzma is serious about basketball. But also, too, like, and I hate the way this term gets thrown around, but he's an alpha male, and he does it in a way that doesn't alienate teammates or, I think, you know, get caught up in either truly irrational confidence or, like, you know, truly selfish play. Like, he grew a lot over the year when it comes to, I think, being more selfless, looking for his teammates more. But he also, though, too, I think of all the young players they have, Kuzma has the most superstar potential in terms of just charisma.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in terms of getting guys to want to play with him, like, you know, taking cues from him. Like Kuzma has real – you can question whether or not he has superstar talent potential, but in terms of –
you know, he's got the attitude.
In terms of wiring, he has the wiring of a superstar, and I think that matters.
We both have Ingram at number one, and for me it's because I think simply he is the best player of all these guys. You know, he makes – his history is one of making leaps. He quietly became a good outside shooter this year. He figured out how to attack the rim despite still being an undersized guy. He can pass the ball. He's a good rebounder. He's got handle. He very obviously wants to be a great player. If you talk to Trudell and the other guys in the building, he is that guy. He is the first one there. He is the last one to leave. And he is working, not playing Fortnite while he is there. Not that the other guys aren't, but it's not fake effort. He's putting it in. He's in a lot of ways, he's Kuzma without the sense of humor. He's Kuzma without the big personality and wanting to talk a lot and being outward about this stuff. Dude's got a lot of dog in him.
Yes, he does.
Criticize him for not having that attitude. I'm like, I don't, you're either not listening to him or not watching him or whatever. He just, it's like saying Kawhi doesn't have it in him because he just doesn't talk a lot. Ingram's a quiet guy, but you know, Kawhi is quiet and very obviously is on the floor in terms of his belief in his talent, his willingness to try to get better and to be the best player in the league, is that guy. And Ingram is as well. He just doesn't talk about it a lot. So you might need another guy with him in LA to play that role for kind of cosmetically for the city, but you don't have to worry about him, you know, not being enough for, you know, to be the best player.
You and I have spent time in that locker room at practice. He's respected among his peers a lot.
Absolutely is.
To me, and I agree with you, he's number one. Nobody among this young core has the greater combination of ceiling, established talent, work ethic, seriousness, and physical tools. I mean, that length is insane.
And he's still a baby.
Yes. He's barely older than Lonzo.
Yes. And so I feel
we've also been fans of Ingram before it was fashionable.
That's true. We were a lot of things before us. We're never fashionable.
No.
It's
really hurt us.
Yeah. Put it that way. I just feel like, you know, the desire to constantly move on to the next thing, you know, Kuzma, to be amazed by the potential of Kuzma, particularly where they got him and how much of an asset he can be for the Lakers, not just as a player, but as a cap figure going for the next couple of years. And the debate around Lonzo, it becomes easy to forget that Ingram, I still think, is the best player of all of them.
Yeah, and the good news, by the way, is that we're even having this conversation speaks to the potential and talent that the Lakers have in front of them.
I don't want to trade any of these five. When it comes to, like, Jordan Clarkson, I was all right with trading Jordan. I mean, I know exactly what that is.
Fine with that.
And I think it's, you know, I didn't have a problem when they signed him. I didn't have a problem when they traded him.
Nope.
I know exactly what he is, and it's fine.
He's a useful NBA player, but you can find useful NBA players.
That guy is the easiest thing to find in the NBA. A backcourt player whose primary skill is scoring.
And DMs.
That guy, yes. That guy is available more than any other player in the league. Nance was a guy who was like, I don't want to give him up. Good player and good team. Didn't have a problem with it. I didn't feel that, like, oh, like this is going to be a something that comes back to bite you.
No, I mean, Nance's defense aside, he is much more easy to replicate than any of the five guys
just
that are still
solid,
around.
Just a solid player. Yeah. I feel like they could find another guy like him at 25 this year.
This is a great dude.
Round.
Both of us liked having him around.
That was the biggest part of it. I don't want to... They've done a remarkably good job with important picks to where the worst guy of the significant picks that you could say was Russell. And even that, it's like, well, they could have taken Okafor, and that would have been way worse. And yeah, they could have taken Porzingis. But, I mean, D'Angelo Russell is a competent NBA player. And if he hadn't had the knee issues, would probably be, you know, further along.
Yeah, I mean, he has growing up to do. But, you know, there are a lot of NBA players who entered the league immature or with attitude concerns,
if he's healthy,
or whatever.
Russell's going to have a real career.
Exactly.
So it just gets to the quality of what they've been doing.
They're in a good, they're optimism, in a great place moving
why
forward.
People are so freaking optimistic that they're going to come away with a great player at 25. I mean, it's starting to be the pressure actually to where if they draft at 25 this year and the guy turns out to be not so good, they're going to get a lot more flack for that than they should.
You're right.
I mean,
people
are going to really pound them for that.
I had not thought about that before.
Oh, they whiffed at 25.
We remember when we first started covering the team, you know, and that was Kobe and Phil's first year back together, the first year of Kwame and Smush and whatever. You know, like people would complain about what they would get. Like, I think Jordan Farmar was 26. We're like, have you seen what most guys do at pick 26?
Go look at the guys that the Suns drafted with the Dwight Howard picks at the end of the draft.
Like, Jordan Farmar is a fine pick at 26. He's a typical.
He played in the league for seven or eight years.
Yeah, I mean, Jordan Farmar is typical of what you get at 26.
No, like, he's better.
I mean, better, he's I should
better.
Say. You're correct.
Significantly
you
better.
You are correct.
Typical
absolutely.
Is.
Guy you forgot
that
about
guy?
Was drafted at 26.
Right.
You're absolutely correct.
I didn't know that
correct.
Guy played in the league.
You're
so,
absolutely correct.
Like the Lakers are at a point now where they're going to start drafting at the end of first rounds or near the end of first rounds or middle of first rounds when most teams don't get great players, and they're going to get crushed for it because they've been so good at it.
Yeah.
So that tells you something there too. I did want to ask you this because Lonzo made the second team all-rookie. Does that constitute a disappointing year? You said at the beginning of the season, you know, that if he doesn't win rookie of the year, that if he doesn't, that it could be really damaging. A year later, essentially, are you off that at all, or is it?
Well, I would say this: in some ways, Lonzo had his ass saved for him by Kuzma making first team. Like, if Kuzma had not made first team or Kuzma hadn't played this well,
it has been a distraction.
And Lonzo still made second team. You know, missing 30 games. And the shooting issues, it would have looked a hell of a lot worse than just finishing behind Kuzma.
Right.
Having said that, though, I mean, it's disappointing in the sense that it reflects a year for Lonzo that was, I think, unsatisfying. You know, it wasn't bad. Like, Lonzo, when he played, was too good to be bad. And the stuff, again, we talked about earlier, that he does well, Lonzo often does exceptionally well.
Yeah.
But it was an unsatisfying year.
It was. I will say, though, I think, Andy, that part of what you were talking about was based on what it might mean for the perception of the team going forward, and where I think there's no real damage for this is because people saw enough potential in Lonzo to know what's there. But also, because of Kuzma, because of Randall, because of Ingram.
Hart?
Because of Hart, because I think people look at Walton differently now.
Because of cap space. More cap space than they had
the
heading
new facility,
into the year.
All these are like some of the burden on Lonzo to sort of turn things around that seemed to be put on him by Magic as much as anyone.
Magic and LeVar, yeah. And Pelinka.
Turned out to be less of a thing. And so because of that, I think there's not a lot of real damage. I mean, he did make second team despite not playing 30 games. So in some ways, you can almost look at it.
Although
and say,
you start looking, though, at the guys who finished with fewer votes behind him, they were kind of running out of dudes. I'm just saying. I mean, and I don't want to take away anything from Lonzo because, again, like we said, when he did play, he often played very well. They're starting to run out of dudes.
No, I understand. But that's always how these things work, particularly with rookies.
I will say this, though. Speaking of running out of dudes, they did not run out of enough dudes that you, I think, could justify Josh Hart not getting a vote.
Yeah. What do you have, like 8 double-doubles, 10 double-doubles, something like that?
A vote. I mean, look at some of the guys who got a vote. Luke Kennard in Detroit.
No.
Frank Mason in Sacramento.
I could see a vote for him, but like no, with a vote for Hart.
Right,
too,
exactly. Right. All of this is with like Malik Monk. Malik Monk didn't have
he
a good
year. Sucked. For
yes.
He sucked into the last, and I know this because, you know, fantasy basketball. He sucked, genuinely sucked, until the last 2 weeks of the season.
Sidarius Thornwell?
He deserves votes for being named Sindarius Thornwell.
Well, I mean, but like, you can't tell me that he had a better year than Hart. Like, you know, Semi Ojeleye in Boston,
no.
Frankie Smokes in New York. Like,
no.
Like, Josh Hart was better than those guys.
Particularly over the second half of the season.
Yes. Like, he, and you and I have also been big, you know, I guess we're kind of Josh Hart stands, and that's fine. Josh Hart played well enough that he should get
you know,
at least
for
one
who
vote.
Gives us all kinds of crap for not being optimistic enough about this team. We like all of their players.
Yes.
Yeah, even the player that I get annoyed by, which is Lonzo, I understand that, again, it's not his fault that his head is too short.
No, we,
and all these other things
we
are
were,
me problems,
we were
not him
super
problems.
Negative about the team when they were inexplicably bringing in Carlos Boozer. I mean, and you know what? We were right. Turned out we were actually right.
We need to watch all of those games, Andy, and come up with an hour of things to talk about
yes.
after each one of those games and pretend that something was going to happen that mattered during those games, and it was not
yeah, it's gonna build some bitterness, man, and I think we earned that bitterness.
Although I'm getting a little bit of flack today for tweeting out that it was a joke that Kobe wasn't on the all defensive team. Sometimes you just got to throw that out there.
Sometimes you got to throw it out there. But I would say, and somebody, at Wait for Dusk on Twitter pointed out you've used that one before.
I have.
I'm just saying. I mean, some of the flack
Andy,
you might get is just come up with something new.
If anybody has listened to this show or heard me on the radio. Or read our blog, or anything like that, they know I'll beat a joke into the ground. And then I'll wait for it to get back up, and I'll beat it down again.
Speaking of recycling material, good a segue as any into the conversation about Solo and Star Wars.
Okay, so we've done this before. <You're>
well, right. No, I meant because they've been recycling.
Well, and I think we've had versions of this conversation.
We've discussed it.
Solo's coming out this weekend.
Solo's coming out this weekend.
And it's getting some decent reviews.
Say it's getting
good, solid reviews.
Yeah,
I would say
B-minus level
yeah,
reviews.
Solid.
Yeah.
And the biggest criticism of it seems to be that it's a movie that nobody asked for, like a Solo origin story. And so that's one of the things I want to talk about too. But before we get there, these movies and the whole Star Wars franchise to me is kind of getting bizarre because now this is the 10th?
Well, there were
three originals,
three prequels. They've done two of the
so that's eight,
sequel now
plus Rogue One. So this is 10.
This will be number 10, and the third of the
post
whatever you want to call them now. It's confusing. That's slated for
next
2019.
Year. Right.
Yes.
Very few of them are good. So legitimately good movies. Like, I think of all of them, IMHO, the only genuinely front-to-back good movie all the way through is Empire. I think A New Hope is close. And I really like Rogue One. But I like it more than a lot of people do.
Including the people in the studio.
Well, certainly more than you. Jedi is half a good movie.
Which one? The Last Jedi or Return of the Jedi?
No, Return of.
Okay,
Return of.
You have to make it clear.
All right, because there are two Jedi, right. Return of the Jedi is half a good movie.
Yes, the first half is very good. The second half
is less
meanders.
Good. Right, less good. All three prequels, and I've heard people try to defend them. Also.
Actually, no, I'm going to disagree with you on this. And some of this may be coming in comparison to what's come since. But I actually recently, it was before The Last Jedi hit theaters. I think it was TNT was doing like marathons.
They're always
right. On. And I actually, for the first time in eons, watched the prequels. I didn't watch them straight through, but I watched parts of all three. And I actually came to realize that particularly the second and the third one, I don't remember the names of them. One of them is like a Sith and the other. But I came to realize that parts of those are actually better than I remember, particularly in the middle one. And a lot of, and I was actually having this conversation with Jeff Katz today. And Katz, you know, for anybody who follows him on Twitter, was going nuts trashing The Last Jedi, which he absolutely despised. And I kinda,
for both movie making reasons and nerdy reasons, about
Katz is a proud
violating the rules of the Jedi
Katz is
Order
a proud member of the Nerd Vortex. Right. He will tell this to anybody. But I came to realize that the prism that I viewed the prequels through was very heavily affected by how I felt about Phantom Menace.
Phantom Menace is the worst of
right.
Of
and Phantom
the three.
Menace has a lot of problems, you know. But if you this is an awful thing to say, but it's true. If you replaced Jake Lloyd, who played young Darth Vader, with a kid who can actually act, and replaced
got rid of Jar Jar Binks,
got rid of Jar Bar altogether, which doesn't make me feel bad at all. Phantom Menace still has issues, but it's a different, better movie that's going to, at least for me, change the way I saw the following two prequels. And I came to realize that there were parts in those movies that were better than I gave them credit for at the time, because I was so angry about the way the Phantom Menace set up everything.
I just watched, I think it is...
I'm not saying they're great
Revenge
movies.
Revenge of the Sith, which I just don't think is very good.
You know what, though?
It's clunky.
The prequels are better than what's come in the last 4 years.
Now, that's an interesting question.
They are better.
And I'm separating Rogue One out of it, because Rogue One is demonstrably better than the prequels and both postquels. Oh, it
I
is.
Don't
it,
agree with
it
that.
Is.
I don't agree with that. The last 30 to 40 minutes of Rogue One are, I think, really good. They're exciting battle scenes. So much filler to get
it's
to that point.
Too long, but
it's
besides,
like an hour
but
too
I
long.
I thought the stuff at the beginning was good, so we just disagree about that.
I never
Awakens,
thought I'd say this. I actually think the prequels are better than what.
That may be, but like the Force Awakens, I found entertaining. I went with my kids, and I saw, but I saw it a second time. Oh my God!
It's Star Wars retold. Right. It's just a remake,
right? Poorly. So it doesn't really. It really does not hold up to repeated viewings in any way. And The Last Jedi, which I thought was better than The Force Awakens, I know you hated it. Is still not great. And I understand why people didn't like it. And they go beyond nerd reasons. And there's all kinds, you know. The whole plot in the casino and stuff, and like there's whole sections of the movie that don't
it's
need to be.
It's a 2.5 hour, like 2.45 minute movie. I don't need to see 15 minutes devoted towards like saving these yaks or whatever the hell they are. I mean, it's like, come on, to like
Gazelle,
to basically
things.
Find Benicio Toro, whose character isn't even needed in the
right,
first
the whole
place.
Thing is unnecessary. There's all kinds of stuff that's just, it's overstuffed and it's, you know, and
so little actually happens.
As by comparison, I took the kids this weekend to see Infinity War.
Yeah.
And
don't get into spoilers because I have not seen it.
It's fun. It definitely is just a setup. It's a giant 2.5 hour setup for the second movie.
Which, by the way, most of these Marvel movies basically exist to set up the next thing. That's the way these universe things work now.
We were entertained the whole time. I think I could sit through it again. The kids really liked it and all that kind of stuff. It did not feel nearly as overstuffed and meandering as Last Jedi did.
I mean, look.
And it actually has less plot than The Last Jedi.
My biggest complaint about the Marvel movies is I think they tend to all be too long. I think all of them could be
It's too long.
Right. They could all be half an hour shorter, other than maybe something like an Ant-Man. But the Marvel movies are, you know, across the board, better made.
Mm-hmm.
They're better made movies.
So
we are grateful, by the way, for the Star Wars movies because they're making bajillions of dollars and they help
company,
pay our
right.
salary.
So without debating.
You couldn't
too much
pay
more,
us without those Star Wars movies.
Without debating too much more the merits of each movie, I think functionally we can agree that there are now 10 movies. Fewer than half anybody would call good. Like, that's a good movie. Like, that hits every button, like, we're good to go, whereas, like...
Universally, I mean, you will find people who will say
sure.
they're very good, but as far as universality...
Of the Fast and Furious franchise, how many would you say are like, yeah, that's a fun movie, it's a good movie, I like that one, I would watch that again.
5, 6, 1, I'd say 5, 6, and 1 are the three best. 7... Little disappointing.
But still watchable.
Still watchable. 4 is odd. Four is odd and has a strange plot, but it has some very exciting scenes in it, including the big tunnel race.
But they're batting over 500.
Oh, yeah. They're definitely batting above 500. You know, Too Fast, Too Furious is a lot of fun, even if it's kind of a piece of crap. The only one that really sucks is Tokyo Drift.
Right.
Tokyo Drift
is legitimately terrible.
Tokyo Drift is bad,
so
and it's boring.
Why? What? This part of it is fascinating to me. The Star Wars franchise as a cultural thing has so transcended the actual quality of the movies in ways that I want somebody to write a book about it, because you know the new generation of kids are into Star Wars. Disney's building a Star Wars experience. You know, my kids know it. Your daughter knows it, and she's not even like a fantasy type person.
No.
Everybody knows these characters, and everybody knows what this is, and it's huge, monumental business. And the core thing that it's built on isn't good comparatively. And I think it's a lot of it is the nostalgia for what Star Wars meant, and the distance now, I think, between 1977, right? And when that first one came out and now, to where we kind of look back on A New Hope and, you know, you can kind of see some of the flaws there and where it might be a little bit dated, but what it meant to people and how it became part of the zeitgeist was so profound, and then followed up by the best movie in the series. And then this massive gap psychologically, it just occupies this weird space where the actual content that it's based on is becoming less and less and less relevant, you know, despite the fact that they're making movie after movie after movie now.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I think like the cultural resonance of the first Star Wars, you know, which hooked everybody in the beginning. I think obviously they, you know, 20th Century Fox recognized quickly they had a big hit on their hands because, you know, people were, you know, circling around the theaters and they had the toys out really quickly and stuff. But, you know, that was a, I don't want to say pure place, because, you know, this is Hollywood. The goal is to make money. And, you know, it was post-Jaws. We're starting to enter the blockbuster.
It was pure in the sense that it was surprising to people what it was. And it was newer.
It was not a money printing machine right when it began. And, you know, one of the things about, one of the big differences that I see in the prequels too, but especially as well the newer ones, is when you think about the first Star Wars, Harrison Ford was an unknown. Mark Hamill was an unknown. Carrie Fisher was an unknown. Like Alec Guinness, you know, obviously had, you know, he'd won an Oscar before, you know, he'd been nominated multiple times. What?
He also hated the movie.
He hated it, but Alec Guinness wasn't the star that he was in like 1957.
Right. But I'm saying, like, the one guy you kind of look at and say, well, here's a real legitimate actor, didn't even like being in the movie.
No, but that's not even my point. My point is it wasn't driven by star power, mm-hmm, in a way that would prevent the character, you know, these actors felt like the characters. You know, Alec Guinness, for a lot of people, felt like Obi-Wan Kenobi, because unless you were of a certain age, you really didn't know him as anything else. Like, you know, Billy Dee Williams as Lando, you know, for certain audiences, particularly white sci-fi, you know, of a certain age, they know Billy Dee Williams as Lando more than anything else.
Right, a commercial pitch man.
Right, but that helps you buy in.
Mm-hmm.
Like that helps transform you in a way that, like,
particularly in an era where you can't make Zoe Saldana look different, where,
right,
you know, who plays plays the bad guy in Infinity War. It's what's his name?
Josh Brolin.
Like he doesn't look like Josh Brolin, and so like you can transform people now. You can have star driven, big budget, box office-y, money-printing ventures like the Marvel movies are, but also take your stars and make them look a little bit different than they are. So you get a little bit of having it both ways.
I guess, but I mean, like, to me,
the unknown factor, the sort of the innocence of it,
but also, too, they keep casting actors in it who don't need to be in it. Like Laura Dern, who is an amazing actress. She's one of my favorite actresses.
It's distracting to see.
Right, exactly.
Recognize.
Benicio del Toro is distracting in that role. And unless he's in the next one, there was absolutely no reason for him to be
in
it.
This is actually where I think the one-offs work a little bit better. Like the standalones work a little bit better. The appearance of people that you recognize aren't as weird because they don't look like they're like hey, I'm a star. Like, Laura Dern shows up on screen. And I like Laura Dern. She's a good actress. She's been, you know, done some good work over the course of her career. She doesn't fit in that universe. Like,
no.
It's weird. She looks like she's visiting that universe, you know, in ways that make... That it's like putting Tom Cruise in that movie. It just doesn't look right. These are people that we know.
There's
and
also
they have a sensibility about them.
There's also too, I think, an issue Star Wars has. You know, the new ones that reminds me a lot of baseball in the sense that I think it has too much reverence towards its past.
Well, that was one of the criticisms of Last Jedi is that it violated some of those rules and it wasn't reverent enough.
Well, but I mean, but ultimately though, they keep looking to bring back factors from the previous ones or these recognition points or, you know, essentially the story of Luke working with Rey, you know, trying to train Rey at, you know, to fight, you know, a protege that went rogue. I mean, this is Darth Vader and Luke and Obi-Wan.
Well, it is, but here's the thing. It's like this is, again, why I would rather they make 10 more movies that are just standalone movies about this universe.
Well, but that's actually something
post going forward where you take the rules of the universe and you come up with a story. Maybe it's Solo where it's an origin story.
And we'll get to that.
Or maybe whatever it is. And we might as well sort of start this conversation now. Those, because you're not, the part of the problem with what was not the one that came before Last Jedi.
Force Awakens?
Yeah, Force Awakens was, like you said, it was a remake of all that stuff. And when these people show up on screen, the 40 years that have gone on between, you know, between the first one and then, Harrison Ford, who I thought was as good as anybody of the old characters and the new ones in terms of playing the role, still felt like he was Harrison Ford pretending to be Han Solo.
He said, I'll be in this movie if you kill me.
If you kill me.
Spoiler
Carrie Fisher.
Alert.
movie is three years old now. Carrie Fisher felt like Carrie Fisher play-acting Princess Leia.
Yes.
And it's not her fault. Too much time has passed. The context is different.
Mark Hamill felt the same way as Luke Skywalker. And he's trying.
He's working his ass off, particularly in this one. I thought he did pretty good. It's not there. So at this point, you're right. It's too hard to watch these things.
And you mentioned Harrison Ford.
With the same people, at least.
Right, and I think Harrison Ford put probably the requisite appropriate amount of energy towards playing Han Solo.
He put more effort into that than he's done in
most of his more recent movies. No, but here's the difference, though. And I don't think you've seen this movie. But if you see Harrison Ford reprising the role of Deckard in Blade Runner 2049, the investment that Harrison Ford has in there, not just because he's trying, but because he clearly believes in the material and respects it more. The difference in Blade Runner 2049 versus what he does in The Force Awakens is night and day. And, you know, again, some of that has to do with Harrison Ford being sick of Han Solo, but some of it has to do with the material is better. There's nothing creative at... I mean, the prequels had their issues, but at least they introduced some new stuff in it. There's nothing new that's been introduced in any of these three new movies.
And we're sort of just talking through this, and, you know, this is why we do these things sort of the end of the show rather than the beginning. I almost don't know if you can make a good version of that movie anymore out of the original trilogy, whether going backwards or forwards.
I don't know.
I wonder if you can even make a good one, like a really good one anymore, because we as an audience bring so much now to it until at least, perhaps, you get through Luke is dead, Yoda's dead, everyone's dead, and now you're only left. Yoda's already dead.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, but like where all that's left are the new, quote-unquote, new characters, you know, emo Darth Vader, Kylo Ren.
Me, someone like Kylo Ren, and I swear we're going to get to Solo after this. Kylo Ren, though, is a mistake. I mean, I don't know if this comes from the books. I don't know, or whatever.
I don't care.
I don't know. I don't care. I'm just saying, in terms of generating problems, to me, Kylo Ren doesn't feel like it has to be the son of Leia and Han, unless you choose that. And once you choose to do that, I feel like you are moving yourself backwards. That guy could have been any villain.
Speaks to the problem.
Could have been any villain.
I think 100 of these, like I am almost positive that I'm going to like Solo more than some of these other ones, even understanding that Solo has some carry through.
I would be more excited about Solo if these other movies hadn't been there. I'd be more excited about it. I'm a little origin storied out.
I think the reason I liked Rogue One as much is because it had like nobody in it that was part of.
Yeah, but there were all these.
Again, we don't have to rehash. Right. But I'm just saying. But that's part of. I think it's like you. It's the only Star Wars movie that's been made where you can go into it where other than I know how this has to end, like they got to get the plans onto the ship.
Spoiler alert.
Again, movie is older, and the
anybody listening to this conversation has seen the
right,
movies.
The part that I'm spoiling here really comes from a movie in 1977. You had a chance to catch up.
That is true.
It's the only one of these things that you can go into where you didn't have a list of preconceived notions. And so, with that in mind, are there any of these origin stories that you'd want to see? Are there any stories of how this happened that you'd want to see? A world that you just want to, you know, this is the hard part with making this. I want to occupy the world more than I want to watch the movies.
The origin story that, I mean, and I don't know if it's currently in production or not, because I know it was, and then there were problems, and last I heard it was on hold. There was a Boba Fett origin story in the works that I would love to see, because Boba Fett is a character that, outside of the truly hardcore fans, we don't really know much about.
Didn't they get into his thing? It's like, wasn't he like a clone? And they came up with. Can you just scrap that?
But not in a movie. I don't think they have really.
Right, but his story was part of the prequels.
Not big. I don't think it was a big part, if I remember correctly. And again, I've only seen parts of the prequels, so maybe I didn't go through all of that. And maybe I don't remember it that well. But I know they have not gone hardcore into Boba.
No, like Jango Fett has the kid who's Boba, and they make the clones out of.
But that's sort of it. I just mean like sort of like something where you set up Jango Fett and Boba Fett. Where, I mean, I'm saying like relatively speaking, we don't know much about who Boba Fett is compared to some of these other people. The reason I would find that interesting, outside of the fact that I've just always liked Boba Fett, like he's always been he's been this inexplicably popular character that said like seven lines of dialogue. He feels like somebody where you don't have to hold fast to anything and you could take some chances. Like, to me, Boba Fett feels like the opportunity to be the Star Wars version of what Ant-Man was. Because like Ant-Man was, and I love Ant-Man, it's a lot of fun, but it's tonally different than a lot of these other ones. And, you know, it ended up a big hit, but it is, relative to Marvel, a small hit. And Boba Fett feels like the one that they could make and say, you know what, this does not have to make $700 million domestically. This can make $200, $175, and let's actually try to make a pretty cool, darker, riskier movie.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, guys like that. I'd like to see a movie about Mos Eisley. Just or like that, just like it doesn't have to have Luke in it, doesn't have to, but like these people that are like occupy these places, these weird places. Walrus guy, but like, you know, some of our Jabba
Hammerhead origin story.
How does a guy like Jabba in a lot of ways functions as, you know, he's like a character in The Wire, like
Jabba would be an interesting origin
Jabba
story.
Jabba would be
too.
Great. It's like, you know, he's kind of working the corner, you know, he's one of these guys that, you know, that built up the empire.
Again, we're getting back to, both of us have managed to pick characters that we still don't know a lot about and are much darker.
Right, and to hang out with other dark people.
Right, right. And again, it allows you, if you do this right, it immediately puts you in a place where you're going to be edgier, not worry about being as likable, take some more chances.
That's why Han was always one of the more appealing characters, because he was not 100%
right,
good.
But
and why Greedo shooting first was such a
But it makes you a bit
mistake.
Concerned that with Solo, they fired the original directors who apparently wanted to be a little more risk-taking and brought in Ron Howard, who I like, but he's not a big risk-taker.
No. Yeah, you're right. Whatever it is, I feel like you got to get out of the, you know, I've seen some suggestions, you know, of some of the Actually, a Yoda origin story would be interesting. You know why? Because you can go back 800 years, you know, or however long. Like, you could tell a story about Yoda and put it in a universe that's so long time ago in a galaxy far, far away that you could do whatever you wanted. Gets to your same point. You know, or like these weird characters like Darth Maul, some of these other guys.
The problem with an origin story for Yoda, while potentially interesting at the end of the day, you're going to have a two and a half, the way they do this movie, 2.5 hour movie centered around a puppet. A little Yoda goes a long way. And I love Yoda. Little Yoda goes a long way.
Overkill this, maybe.
Do you know what I'm saying? No, like, that's a lot for a Muppet to carry.
It's a fascinating dilemma where you have this thing where you almost, where financially you have to keep making
movies. Well, I was going to say, it's both a dilemma and a non-dilemma.
But there's no choice but to keep making movies.
Yes.
Like, it is economically suicidal. Is it crass commercialism? No question. But it's economically suicidal to not keep making these movies. They need to keep being made. But if you have any interest in making them good, how do you do it and where do you go? It's a fascinating question. But anyway, I'm gonna go see the Solo. My kids want to see it, so I'm gonna go see it as well.
Yeah, you know what? I'm curious. I just wish I were excited.
The extended trailers that I've seen look better than the original. Like, the teaser trailers look problematic, but I've liked it more. I'm getting used to that kid playing Solo, and I like what Donald Glover's done with Lando. People seem to be into that.
Well, it's Donald Glover's moment right now. Yeah, like, I guarantee he could be awful in this movie. Universal praise.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah,
he's in his Beyonce moment right now. And I love Donald Glover. I'm a big fan. But he's right now in the you don't attack Donald Glover moment.
No, it's true. I like that little the throwaway that they have where, you know, where we find out that Chewie's like 198 years old or something like that, and you look great. I'm optimistic. We'll go see that. But it's a fascinating franchise, much like the Lakers, and we'll get back to talking about them next week. Anything else?
I think
we've gone through it all. All right, see everybody next time.